I'm Randy, the pastor half of the podcast, and my friend Kyle's a philosopher. This podcast hosts conversations at the intersection of philosophy, theology, and spirituality.
We also invite experts to join us, making public a space that we've often enjoyed off-air, around the proverbial table with a good drink in the back corner of a dark pub.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.
So today we're talking with Tom and Alexa Ord. Tom might sound familiar to you if you heard our previous interview with him. It goes by Thomas J. Ord on his books. And we talked with him about omnipotence a little while back. And just a few days later had this conversation about a completely different topic. Tom is a member, a leader, really, I guess, in the Church of the Nazarene. And wrote, edited a book about why that denomination should go fully LGBTQ affirming. And he edited that book with his daughter, Alexa, who was in publishing. So kind of happy merge there. Worked out nicely for them, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I guess Tom kind of, or maybe they together kind of run a publishing company. And so this is an enormous volume. It's like 500 pages. And it has, I don't know how many, a lot of essays by people in that denomination from three perspectives. There's a chunk of people who are in the LGBTQ community and in that denomination. There's a chunk of people who are straight allies, and then there's a chunk of scholars in various disciplines. And they all came together under that very straightforward title, Why the Church of the Nazarene Should Be LGBTQ Affirming, I think it's something like that. Yeah, and so we had a really good conversation about the core lines of argument in that perspective, how much of it is generalizable beyond their own denominational context. The answer to that is a lot. This is something we talked about a lot before and we care a lot about, and it's going to keep coming up on the show. And Tom was someone we really enjoyed talking to, and so when we saw this, it was just kind of a no-brainer to have him on and talk about it again.
Yeah, and just a reminder, Tom is a scholar. He's a theologian, a brilliant one at that. And the Church of the Nazarene, if you're not familiar, it's a large denomination, and it's rooted in the Wesleyan movement. So in my Protestant, you know, moorings, that's a really good tradition. Like, the Wesleyans care about social justice. They care about the whole person and human flourishing. And I think whether you find yourself as non-denominational, those are for those of you who consider yourselves Christian. If you consider yourself non-denominational, Methodist, you know, even some form of Baptist, I don't know how many Baptists are listening to our show, but I'm trying to say this is a very, very mainline denomination. This is a denomination that's very representative of the rest of the evangelical movement, and they're having these conversations. And I hope your denomination or network or movement is having these conversations as well. And I hope you have a Tom Ord and Alexa Ord in the midst of those conversations, because they're really important voices. So I'm excited for this conversation, and I'm excited for the tasting that we're about to do, because if you don't know this show, we are a pastor and a philosopher walk into a bar. We like hosting conversations that sound like you're in a bar. They're a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more laid back, a little bit more honest and raw. And because of that, we like to sample an alcoholic beverage, and I love meads. Kyle has introduced me and brought me into the world of meads, and I love them. So Kyle, what are we drinking here?
Yeah, so the first mead that we had on the podcast was called Elliot. It's a blueberry mead from a place called Manic Meadery in Indiana.
I lost my brain.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. I've still never had a better blueberry mead. This one is called Little Elliot because it's a session version of that. So session just means it's lower ABV. It's carbonated usually. And it aims at something different. So I would try in your brain to not compare them, because they're going to be very different experiences. But this is a straight blueberry session mead. Comes in at
6.8.
Yeah, 6.8%. So just think, what would I like to drink hanging in a hammock on an 80-degree Wisconsin day? Yeah. This is what I was doing yesterday. and think of it in those terms, yeah.
Got it. So good. hope you're listening, friends, right now. And I hope you're listening to my response. And I hope you're jealous, because you should be. This is delicious. It's all those things. It's lighter. It's a little bit less flavor. But it's easier drinking. And it still has all the beautiful blueberry mead flavors to it.
Yeah. And if you like carbonation, because it just feels more fun in summer, this has that in a way that still meads don't. Yeah.
Oh. So you can't... Can you get Manic Meadery meads? Can someone find this at a really, like, bougie liquor store?
Not at a store, but believe it or not, they do ship. I don't know if they ship cans, but they definitely ship their bottles. So if you go to their website, it's through a company called Vino Shipper, same people that ship wine. But you can order bottles to your house, yeah.
So if you're listening and you are into the tastings that we do, you're not one of the people that skip the tasting, order some mead from Manic Meadery and send us an email and tell us
your
thoughts.
Great introduction to mead, yeah. Really good stuff.
Yeah,
it's delightful. This is just super easy drinking and summer. I mean, it's just summer.
It's like
glass.
Blueberries and lavender and a little bit of sweetness with some bubbles. I mean, this is what, like, White Claw aspires to be.
Oh my God, can you imagine? Yes, gosh, I used to remember reading a bunch of memes about White Claw and like how they get the flavor into it. It's like they set it on a table and then on the other side of the table they put the fruit and they leave it there for a few seconds and then take it away. This is definitely what White Claw wishes it was.
Yeah, if you taste a sip of this and you say you don't like it, I don't trust your opinion on anything.
On anything.
It's a little hyperbolic, but it's close. It's close. So,
nice.
Thanks for the pour. Cheers.
Yeah, man. Cheers. Speaking of opinions on things, do we have any new reviews?
We do. We've gotten a couple of new reviews, which we love it when you guys leave reviews. It strokes our ego and helps the algorithms get us into the places where we're hoping to get into. So just this last week, somebody who named themselves Your Name Here, 001, whatever your name is, I'm grateful for you. It says, fruitful conversations is the subject. And he or she says, I'm often blessed, frequently challenged, and always excited for the next conversation. Kyle and Randy approach topics with humility and care, always thoughtful and honest. I wish we could all sit and share a spirit, small s, with the spirit, big S. Thanks, you guys.
Nice.
So thank you, Your Name Here, 001.
Yes. If you want to share a spirit with us, there is a way. You just have to become a Patreon subscriber at least the top shelf level, and we share beverages together annually. Or if you really want to see us even more often than that, subscribe at the Pappy level, and once a month we'll read a book together. And if you want to share a drink, we totally can.
Yeah, speaking of which, we want to do a little plug, because we have a really exciting opportunity. We have a book club. That's the Pappy Love that Kyle just talked about. $50 per month, and you get all the perks of the top shelf. Plus, we study a book that we've talked about on this podcast together once a month on Zoom, and it's a really rich time, beautiful time. We are just diving into Bridget Eileen Rivera's book in our book club, Heavy Burdens. And I thought, let's just reach out to Bridget and see if she'd be interested in joining us for a book club night when we're at the tail end of the book. And turns out Bridget is an amazing person, and she said yes. So if you're interested in the conversation with Bridget Eileen Rivera, again, she wrote the book called Heavy Burdens. There, about a year ago, we released it, more than a year ago. It's a great two-part conversation. Listen to that. And if you're interested in just being able to chat with Bridget about her experience and why she wrote the book, what she's working on next, all sorts of fun stuff, join our Happy Level Patreon and join us on August, I think it's 17th, we'll be chatting with Bridget Eileen Rivera.
Another thing we like to do here occasionally is shout out some of those Patreon supporters who have been at the top shelf level for a little while. So Jessica and Matt Battaglia, thank you guys
and Matt.
For listening. Yeah, thanks for supporting. We really appreciate it.
You guys keep us going. Thank you so much for your support. Well, Tom and Alexa Ord, thank you so much for joining us on A Pastor and a Philosopher Walking to a Bar. Tom, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to hang out again.
Alexa, thank you for joining us with your dad. You guys wrote this book or edited this book. It's a massive book with just tons and tons of voices, both queer voices, affirming voices, scholarly voices, and some of your own. It's called Why the Church of the Nazarene Should Be Fully LGBTQ Plus Affirming. Alexa, we talked to your dad, you know, a bit ago, and we heard about his exploits and what he does. Why are you here talking to us?
Yeah, sure. So I originally got a degree in gender studies, did my master's in gender studies. And that was sort of the reason why I'm involved in the first place. That when Tom was sort of thinking about writing some sort of book about the Nazarene Church becoming fully affirming, he reached out to me to sort of collaborate on the project because I could bring that sort of gender studies perspective. It was something that I really cared a lot about. It's a great sort of like merging of our two worlds. So I got brought onto the project to help sort of, you know, spearhead all of the behind the scenes stuff, and then also do a lot of the sort of, you might call it like sensitivity editing, you know, basically trying to make sure that even if our contributors don't have a gender studies degree and have maybe the most up-to-date language, that their ideas are still being expressed in a way that is amenable to all.
Got it. So your dad, obviously, you know, he's one of those guys that we would say, why are you still in the Church of the Nazarene? You know, you seem like a kind of a black sheep and, you know, you're subversive witness within it, which every tradition needs. Alexa, would you say that you're still a part of the Church of the Nazarene, or what's your relationship with the church?
I am not. I left the church, I don't know, how old am I now? Maybe 9 or 10 years ago, and I no longer am religious at all or spiritual. But even though, you know, I would, to put a point on it, I would not even call myself agnostic because I just don't think about religion in my day-to-day life from a personal perspective. But it's still a lens through viewing the world and an ethic that I care deeply about because of how I was raised and the community that, you know, brought me up. And so even though I am no longer religious at all, I still am really dedicated to exploring the future for this community and trying in my own context to merge the worlds of, you know, evangelicalism that I was raised in and the folks that I talk to now that maybe were not raised like that.
Well, I'm tempted to just like turn left and just talk to you about why you're not in the church anymore and why you're not religious anymore, Alexa. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners are really interested about that. So we might have to revisit that at some point. But I think a lot of people who listen to our show are really identifying with you right now or resonating with you in that story.
And I'd at love least to hear one of the hosts.
Yeah. He's pandering now because he's more spiritual than he comes off. Thanks. Tom, I'd also be interested to hear how it is being a theologian, philosopher, pastor, elder in the Nazarene church and have a daughter who said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks to this whole church and spirituality thing.
Yeah, well, that's a good question because, you know, the questions of God are really important to me. I've written tons of books on those subjects. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And I think Alexa is correct. She's not religious or spiritual in the usual senses of those words. But I would say she's spiritual in a more unorthodox sense. But my notion of spirituality is pretty broad and includes people who care about doing the right thing, who want to live in harmony with humanity and the earth. And with that notion of spirituality, I'm sorry if it sounds like I'm imposing, Alexa, but I think you're spiritual in that sense of the words.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the book. It's, as we said, it's enormous, and I'm not going to pretend that I got through all of it, but I did skim some things that seemed pretty interesting. So why did you write it? What is its purpose, and who is its target audience?
I have long been planning to write a book on this subject and talk to people about it. I changed my mind on the LGBTQ issues, or what we used to call homosexuality, back in the early 90s when I was in graduate school at actually a seminary, the Nazarene Theological Seminary. And I've been thinking about these issues for a long time. But a year and a half ago or so, a group in the denomination officially brought charges against me on matters of theology and polity related to sexuality. The theology questions were not the theology charges were not strong, But they were exactly right that my view on human sexuality was different from the denomination. I have a fully affirming position, and the denomination does not have that kind of view. So my local district superintendent took me into his office and said, here are the charges. You can walk away from the denomination, or you can go through a trial. And because I've been through a trial before, I told him I was intending to do the trial, but I needed to ask my wife first, because these things are difficult on relationships, especially family. After her blessing, I went ahead with the trial. And in that trial, I laid out reasons why the denomination should change. So instead of kind of trying to play defense to say, you know, you really should let me stay in the church, because even though my views don't exactly align, I played offense. I said, the church should change, not me. Surprisingly, the group that heard my arguments recommended that I not be disciplined. That went to the next level, and those people heard the case. And in that situation, they needed two signatures for me to be disciplined, and they didn't get that. So the case was dropped, but my superintendent decided he was going to take away my local assignment anyway. In the Church of Nazarene, if you're an ordained elder, you have to have an assignment. And I have an assignment in the local church. It's an unpaid thing. He took that away from me. And then he eventually told me I could no longer preach. That was in last fall or so. And I started thinking to myself, I think the denomination is trying to silence my voice, and I don't think that's right. So I thought for a bit that maybe I would write that monograph that I had been planning. And then I thought, no, it would make a lot more sense if we did an edited book with lots of voices. And that's when I approached Alexa about this project. We sent our invitations to people, was it last November, Alexa? I can't remember.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
So yeah, Tom reached out to me with this idea to write this collection of essays. And I was really excited, largely because I had very little exposure to the overlap of queer issues and the Nazarene church. Even, you know, growing up as a queer person in the church, it was something that was just never talked about. And I thought, well, I don't even know who we're going to get to write, because as far as I know, nobody's queer in the Nazarene church, right? So I was really excited to sort of hear and create a place for those conversations that I wished that I had had growing up. And so we reached out to a ton of people who then also reached out even further and amassed ultimately 90 essays from a broad range of perspectives. We were really trying to encompass as many sort of inputs as we could, you know, biblical scholars who are, you know, a big names in the denomination, all the way to just local people who, you know, are queer or are allies or are parents of queer children who have their stories to tell. Because we had heard that the district superintendents and sort of, you know, the powers that be get a lot of feedback from people who are upset about the gays, you know, gets a lot of homophobic feedback, but they don't really hear from people who are affirming. And we thought, okay, well, this is a chance to sort of call everyone to take a stand. You know, the book is very clear on the cover. If you're participating in this book, there's no wishy-washy. You're standing with us. And so we wanted to really push people to finally come out, stop whispering, and say, yes, I'm affirming. Or if you're queer, this is a chance to really share for everyone else. This is my story. This is what the church has done to me, whether that's joyful, whether that's painful, or somewhere in between. We really wanted to just a huge encompassing of everyone who is behind this issue.
You can imagine, given our title and the boldness of this, that there were lots of people who wanted to write, but who felt like they would lose their job if they wrote, or they would have to relive old trauma as a queer person if they wrote, or, you know, they would, like one person who was a major leader, his wife said to him, look, if you do this, you could lose your job, we could lose your pension. So, in that case, the person didn't write. In other cases, people did write. So there's a lot more people who could have written, but the stakes were just too high for some of them. And we made sure to tell those people, we understand you know, we're not shaming anybody here, but we're also not going to compromise the bold title and what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Brilliant. Alexa, how is it? How is sitting in on conversations like this? This is, you know, you saw the outline. We're talking about how your dad got to be to the point of where he is affirming, or how other people might be, or what's our journey been, all that stuff. I mean, we're all affirming here, but we're all a bunch of straight people talking about LGBTQ issues. How is that from your perspective? Is that tiring? Is it a little bit exciting, a little bit annoying, a little bit obnoxious, a lot? How is that from your perspective?
Yeah, sure. No, I think it's really exciting. I think that it's encouraging to me I think that when an average person who is not a Christian, or especially not an evangelical Christian, thinks of a, you know, white man who is at all connected to evangelical Christianity, they assume they're really, you know, homophobic people. And so I think that it's really encouraging me for me to see sort of the breadth of this conversation. And I personally don't find it tiring. You know, I also am not, I'm in a unique position because I didn't leave the church over this issue. I've never felt sort of like persecuted, or that my parents didn't accept me, or, you know, like I don't have sort of that traditional trauma that comes along with being queer in the church. So that's not particularly tiring for me. It's also been a real sort of point of connection. You know, I have been away from the church for so long that it's been great to sort of realize and discover what's been happening while I've been gone. You know, that there has been a lot of movement on this issue, and that, like I said before, there were all these queer people all along that we just all didn't talk to each other. We didn't know. And so in some ways it's been a really healing experience of sort of reconnecting with the church community that I grew up with, in a way where I can be more authentic and where we can all sort of like come together alongside.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you, Alexa. Talk a little bit about how we've come to an affirming position on LGBTQ+. Tom, you wrote about the different ways people or movements find themselves changing their minds and their stances on human sexuality, whether it's changing our minds about what the Bible says, changing our minds because of experience and relationships with queer people who love and live like Jesus, or changing our minds on intellectual grounds, like listening to psychologists and other scientists and experts in their fields, or, as for me, all of the above, to be honest. How did you personally come to an LGBTQ affirmation, and define what you mean by affirmation?
Yeah, I came to be affirming in the early 1990s, and it was almost entirely on intellectual grounds. I was in graduate school. I was thinking about this issue. I wanted to get to kind of the bottom of things. So I did what a lot of Christians do. They go to the Bible first and look at the 7 or 8 passages that pertain to this, and they read the commentaries, and they read all this, that, and the other. And I and some other friends kind of embarked on this task. And at the end, I just, on intellectual grounds, thought that it was that a person could be in a same-sex relationship and it be healthy for those in the relationship psychologically, emotionally, physically, etc. Most people, however, are not like me. Most people change their mind because someone they know is queer. And they begin to trust them. They see that this queer person is, you know, not any different than other people, not that they're perfect or anything, but they're just like regular people. And that's what changes their mind. I think the science side of things probably affects some people, but of the three that you mentioned, I suspect that's the least influential. maybe someone who's strongly scientifically minded, that would be different. But at least in my experience, it's usually the relationships that's the big turning point.
For the listeners who might not be quite familiar with the terminology of the differences between the various kinds of stances that you can take, including, I've heard the word affirming used differently in different corners as well, let's make that as explicit as we can, because there are a lot of evangelicals who use words that sound a whole lot like affirming, but that still have pretty strict limits. And so let's be really clear.
Yeah, this is something Alexa and I talked about when we were putting the book together, because you know, it's tempting to try to set a big long list of what's in and what's out, behavior wise, identity wise, yeah, orientation wise. And Alexa and I are actually not exactly on the same page. We're similar, but we have a little bit differences. And so we eventually kind of settled on the language of affirming means that you affirm a person's identity, behavior, orientation, so long as those things are expressed in a healthy kind of way. So it's not anything goes. It's not let's have sex with rabbits or, you know, let's, you know, have sex with children, whatever. Using the word healthy, realizing that healthy is not exactly a black and white word, right? there's going to be some debate on what's healthy, what's not healthy, but we want to avoid this sort of extreme relativism as anything can go. Is that fair, Alexa?
Yeah, absolutely. And another sort of thing on this topic is that I know that the contributors in the book differ on this. And in editing it, when I'm wearing my Alexa hat, reading those essays, I thought, oh, I wish that this were more expansive for my own opinion, you know, but in my editor role, well, that's not my role, you know, where I want to leave inlets for all kinds of readers. One thing that I wanted to really make sure we did not do with this book, and when we wrote the introduction together, Tom and I, and started discussing, okay, well, what does it mean to be affirming and, you know, quote unquote, where do we draw the line, is that I wanted to really avoid something called homonormativity, which you've probably heard the word heteronormative, which means, you know, that we all sort of live in a world in which you're expected for a man to marry a woman, have kids, or sort of, you know, the traditional hallmark role of what a life is like. Homonormativity is similar in that it looks exactly the same, except they're gay. So basically, the sort of argument from gay people can be married and have kids and have the white picket fence and be just like you and me. They just happen to have sex with men, you know? I really wanted to leave room for queer joy and queer expression in all of its many forms. And I think that the book really did that. And I understand that, you know, it can be a lot easier for some folks to build relationships with queer people who maybe have a more traditional life structure as sort of their inlet. But I didn't want to limit us to just, we will affirm queer people if they look like straight people, except they have sex with, you know, people of the same gender.
Which is, I mean, an argument could be made that that's still a kind of heteronormativity, right?
Yep. That's the thing is, heteronormativity sinks a lot deeper than just, you know, what's happening in your sex life.
Well, and if the recent Pew polls are correct in the category of queer, it's the bi folks who are by far the biggest. And so, you know, once you start taking into account the intersex, the asexual, all that sort of stuff, it gets messy really quickly. Although we use the phrase LGBTQ+, we also use the word queer an awful lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, pastorally, I've just being an affirming church, I want to be honest with people and let them know where they are, especially if they're new people to our church. I don't want them to hear 10 months after the fact, after they've been around, that we're an affirming church. So I sit down and have a cup of coffee and talk. And that's one of the things that comes up. And it's always the most, you know, I don't know. I'm going to try to be pastoral in this podcast and not, you know, be rude, but it's arduous. And there are all sorts of like little layers that straight people have, straight Christians in particular, of like, okay, you've convinced me a little bit about the sex thing, but what about trans, you know, or what about this? You know, there's always a, but what about that's next? And that's so tiring. I mean, it's tiring for me as a straight white male pastor who's affirming. I can't imagine how tiring and exhausting that is for the queer community.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's so tough, and it's a real gift if a queer person, you know, shares their story with you and does that labor with you that, you know, I think we've, especially in putting together this book and then the corresponding conference, we really tried to be thoughtful of, okay, are we using this these stories in a helpful way, or are we sort of just sort of capitalizing on trotting out the same trauma over and over again? Mm-hmm. Because you're right, it does get tiring to tell these same things about people who are nitpicking your life and, you know, questioning your very humanity. And so we really tried to be mindful of that as best we could. And we included some mental health resources in the back and have sort of like tried to provide community supports after the book's publishing, because you're right, it is a real drain. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like about this book is that it has a very clear purpose. It's like laser focused on accomplishing a single task, and it's therefore, I think, avoids a lot of those issues. So we're not Nazarene, obviously. In fact, I don't know anything about the denomination. it's one of the, I don't know, one of the few evangelical-ish denominations I have zero experience with, so... So we have no horses in this race, so to speak, and so we're mostly interested in the book for the sake of the more generalizable emphases that it has and its relevance to the broader Christian community, and there's a ton in there that is relevant in that way. So let me ask you, how generalizable is this stuff? I think the answer is a lot, but let me put it this way. Is your affirming stance, this can be to both of you, but probably more to Tom, is your affirming stance peculiar to or particular to Nazarene commitments in some way, or Nazarene history in some way? Or do you think the affirming stance is normative for all Christians, or maybe just normative for all humans? I'll let you interpret that how you want.
Yeah, I think it's normative for all humans. I think particular denominations might have aspects of their theology or history that might incline them to address these particular concerns in their own kind of way. The Church of the Nazarene is part of the Wesleyan or Methodist movement. It has a history of that kind of theology, but typically more conservative on social issues. It broke away from the Methodists because it thought the Methodists were getting too liberal and not emphasizing sanctification. Sanctification was oftentimes understood in terms of keeping certain rules. You know, the little phrase, you don't dance, smoke, or chew, or go with girls who do. It was sort of a rule-oriented kind of approach.
Man, what a fun life.
That's right. I mean, yeah, when I was a kid, when I was a little boy, I got out of going to school dances because I claimed I had a religious exemption.
Yeah, I mean, in our last conversation, Tom, we asked you what your favorite alcoholic beverage is, and you were like, hey, I'm realizing after reading the holiness stuff in your tradition that, like, oh, Tom probably doesn't drink.
I don't drink, yeah. And now there are Nazarenes who do, but they're in the minority.
Yeah.
So... what is unique about the Church of the Nazarene? Well, a good portion of us think that the heart of what it means to be holy, the heart of what it means to be sanctified, is to live a life of love. And one of the arguments for this book, I like to think it's the main argument, is that living a life of love means affirming what promotes the well-being of others, humans, the planet, etc. And we think that queer people can be in healthy, well-being type relationships. And so because we're supposed to be about love in our tradition, we ought to be fully affirming of LGBTQ plus people.
Mm-hmm. And what is the metric by which one determines well-being, either in the tradition or for you personally, or both?
Yeah, it's one of those kinds of questions that's hard to answer, right? Because if you have an expansive enough view of well-being, it's going to include, I mean, I not only think it includes non-humans, I happen to have a theology that thinks that God has well-being that we can enhance. So, like, it's a pretty broad category here, and adjudicating it can be very difficult. So that's where it does help to bring in some of the studies that are done in sociology, in the psychology, and say, look, these things are done. They show that, you know, queer people can have relationships that improve positivity and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's a way to bring science in to kind of substantiate the relational intuitions we have.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, that's the one that got me actually, like, I was just on the cusp as a pastor for a long time. And then all of a sudden I heard Matthew Vines quote Jesus when he said, "You'll know a tree by its fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot produce good fruit." When he said it, I was like, that's true. And that's really obvious. Like, I think human flourishing or human well-being or good fruit and bad fruit are not so complicated to identify, you know, like, especially when we're talking about this issue, when you talk about, you know, queer youth are three times more likely to struggle with anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation if they're in a non-affirming home and space, or queer youth are eight times more likely to struggle with all the terrible mental health issues if their family accepts them or not. I mean, there's just so much data and so much conversation. If your head isn't in the sand, it's really obvious of what's good fruit in this conversation and what's bad fruit. And the church has been bearing bad fruit for a really, really long time and trying to call it good fruit. And it's nonsensical. And I think it's obvious. I mean, unless we're talking about the most fundamentalist, you know, choose your own truth, choose your own reality kind of person who's really just chosen to just check out of reality. I think it's very, very clear, actually. Sorry, I had to go on a rant a little bit.
I like that. You're getting to preaching going there. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
it's just not hard to tell.
I'm totally on your side of things. Let me tell you the number one response to our critics, and then let me tell you the number one thing I think is motivating our critics. The number one response is always the Bible. So I'll post the picture of the book that says why the church should be affirming, and they'll respond, "I read the Bible," or "I stand with Scripture," or "Man shall not lie with a man," or, you know, Romans chapter 1. Well, you know, they go straight to the Bible, and it's a particular reading, and they think there's only one interpretation of those passages. And so that's the most common response from critics. Now, what I think is going on deeper than that is an aesthetic element. I call it the yuck factor. I think that some people are repelled by the notion of same-sex affection, same-sex intercourse. And it's kind of like some people don't like snakes and they just have a natural reaction against snakes, or in my case, I like snakes, but I hate the smell of tuna fish. And I walk into a room of tuna fish, I just, ugh. I think that is a major, not the only, but a major motivator for critics of our book.
Yeah. And to sort of add on to that there also, which we kind of got on this conversation during the conference the other day, of talking about why, I think, Tom, you said that you find more often women Christians are more often amenable to becoming affirming. I think that really comes back to the yuck factor also, which, so basically, like, you know, Tom, you talk about the yuck factor, where does that come from? And I think it comes from the patriarchy. It comes from the patriarchy, that because of the way that things are set up, we as a society are even more prone to seeing specifically male homosexual sex as more like having the quote unquote the yuck factor. And I think that's why it's often so much harder for men to become affirming if they're not raised that way, because the yuck factor culturally is so much stronger when talking about gay male sex than about, you know, queer lesbian sex or whatever.
There's a ton of patriarchy behind that too. I'm really glad you took that next step, because that was going to be my next question. Where do you think that yuck thing comes from? Because in my experience, a lot of it's obviously constructed. And it can be obviously deconstructed. I don't have that experience anymore, and I used to. And it's also, I think, in many ways, performative amongst men in particular, trying almost manufactured intentionally in some spaces because it's the normative thing to feel. Yeah,
I have a theory, and I'm going to put it this way: if I could put together 10 questions to give 100 people at random, and these 10 questions had to do with sexuality, like penises, vaginas, anus, breasts. I had all of this language that was really wet and sassy when it comes to sexuality. And if when they answered these questions, they didn't have to be queer questions, just general sex kinds of questions. The people who are most squeamish about talking about sex in general are probably going to be the people who are least likely to be affirming. Mm-hmm. I think there's a correlation between just comfortable thinking about sex in general and comfortable thinking about queer people. Now, I think this is something we could set up as a scientific experiment, see if I'm right about this. I'd love to see if I am.
Yeah, I'll agree with there also on that same thing, Kyle, what you're talking about of the sort of performative yuck factor. I mean, the thing is, everything they're doing in gay sex, you can do with your wife if you try hard enough. It's not that.
I remember I went to a private Christian school, very fundamentalist, from basically fifth grade all the way through high school. And they brought in a quote-unquote sex ed, I'm making air quotes for those who can't hear, person, because they didn't want to do, actual sex education. So they brought in somebody from another Christian nonprofit kind of situation to basically just tell us about all the STDs. And I remember I remember weaponizing the yuck factor in that class just because I was a stupid kid trying to be funny. And so I asked her a question about anal sex, but hetero. Man, you should have seen her face. I feel a little guilty about it now, but it was really fun at the time. I had no idea what to say. Because you're supposed to feel it, that, yeah, you're supposed to think it's yucky.
I wonder, I mean, alongside your imaginary survey, Tom, wouldn't it be great if we could also have like long-term tracking data for people who once they become affirming, how much better their sex life becomes? I'm sure that'd be great.
There is a commercial for becoming affirming.
There it is, right there.
You'll get all the men. Yeah, I think in going back to the relationship thing, that's where the yuck factor ended for me. The yuck factor was clear and present when it was just a couple of dudes on a screen or at a pride parade or whatever. And I didn't see much of it because I was a very sheltered Christian boy. But when my first friend, true friend, who I loved and respected and admired, who was very openly gay, had somebody who I don't know if he loved or had just a lot of large amount of affection for, and I'd see them being holding hands or kissing. My immediate thought went to, I'm so glad for this person. I'm so glad that my friend has someone he can feel loved and cherished by. And that's when it ended for me. And that's just another case of if you create this bubble where there's no queer people allowed and there's no queer voices allowed, I just pray for those people because it's really hard to actually get through in some ways, I feel like.
Yeah.
So there's part of what you said, Tom. I really enjoyed your kind of defense. I don't know what you call it at the end of the book, where you're defending yourself and the accusations made against you, and you do so respectfully and
thanks,
really really well. But I think this is a really interesting kind of biblical take, because I know there's a good amount of Christian pastors who are listening, who are thinking about this, who, through our past episodes and through their experience with, gay people, queer people showing up and wanting to be accepted and loved by that church, they're struggling and they're trying to figure these things out. And the scriptures have a lot to do with it. Like if I feel like there's scriptural backing for it, I can do it. And I know there's a lot of pastors who affirm women in leadership. So let's kind of talk about that. There are people saying that you should be careful about affirming women in leadership because the Bible was written in an ancient context and patriarchal world, because it's a slippery slope that will lead you eventually to affirming homosexuality, right? A lot of people saying don't affirm women in leadership because eventually you're going to affirm homosexuality. And I want to say it's true, and it's a really great slippery slope. Like it's a fun water slide.
Slip and slide. Yeah.
Like, come on.
Who doesn't like slippery slopes? People pay money for this.
Yeah. And Jesus is in the pool to reach you at the end of the slippery slope.
He's walking on the water.
Yeah, dude. Yes. We could go so far with this analogy, but you mentioned that in your tradition, Tom, many are able to contextualize the Bible and include and bless women in full leadership in the church, but aren't willing to do the same contextualizing when it comes to human sexuality. Can you just speak to that dynamic? Do you think it's hermeneutically inconsistent to be affirming of women in leadership or pro-racial equality for that matter, but not LGBTQ affirming?
I do think it's inconsistent. I try, though, to put the best spin I can on those who have different views than I do on this. So I posted some information in a Facebook group of Nazarene women clergy, and there were a couple of women who really came back strong. They did not like the linkage, the analogy between women in ministry and affirming queer people. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. One of our persons at the conference thought it was an attempt to hold on to power. I don't know if that's the case or not. I suspect some of it might have to do with the yuck factor. I don't know. It may be that they just haven't been presented with another way to interpret those passages. You know, one of the things I'm learning as the critics come after us for this book is that there's some people, I mean, they are just so hostile. They don't seem to even want to think any, you know, other than they don't even want to give us a hearing. But there's lots of people who I think actually have pretty good motives. And they just have never heard alternative interpretations of things. So, like, for instance, the passage I think is the strongest one that a person like me has to deal with is Romans chapter 1, in which Paul talks about women laying with women, putting aside their natural urges for what's unnatural, and men with men. I mean, I think that is the strongest passage in Scripture, because the Leviticus passage about men lying with men is right in the context of lots of other things that none of us care about, like wearing clothing of two different kinds of fabrics. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more people understand that the Sodom and Gomorrah story is really about rape. It's really about inhospitality, especially because there's other biblical passages that talk about, you know, that as an issue. But that Romans one, that one I think is just kind of spelled out in such a way that a lot of people don't know how to interpret it any other way than it being against LGBTQ stuff. Now, one of the most common responses is to say, well, they're talking about practices common in Rome. This is a practice in which men often had young boys as sexual partners, but they also had women. And that's not the same as, let's say, two men who are adults who have an intimate companionship for a lifetime. That's a good argument. I'm not discounting that. But I think that the stronger argument is the fact that the word used there for natural in Romans is the same word that Paul uses to say that it's unnatural for men to have long hair. Now, just about everybody in American society knows that after the Beatles came, you know, we don't think that anymore, right? We know men can have long hair, and that's nothing wrong with that. That's a cultural thing. So when they hear that that's the same word Paul's using in Romans chapter 1, that gets a lot of people closer to saying, oh, well, maybe that was something for that time, and it expresses Paul's particular take on things. So all that to say, working through the Bible passages is important in this process.
Mm-hmm. Alexa, I'm interested in your take on, you know, what Tom just said about women kind of being offended about, like, hey, don't compare us with that community. It sounds a lot like what we've seen of other marginalized people groups kind of sniping at each other or trying to claim their ground. I don't know what's your take on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a real example of when you are sort of the best or the worst in as far as oppression goes, you know, when you have the most amount of power amongst the oppressed. Man, it's a whole lot nicer and more comfortable to cling on to that power and to side with the people one rung above you than to relinquish that power and band together with every people on the below you. So I think it can be, I also think that there's in some ways a lot of internalized misogyny for many women in the church that it is probably really hard to grow up if you in a really traditional context being expected to be, you know, have a lot of your opportunities and freedoms cut off. And sometimes it's easier to tell yourself that that's what God wants and that's what you want. And if you cling on to that harder, that's a lot more comfortable than breaking that down to, you know, it requires a lot more internal work and a lot more shaking up of your own emotions. So I understand it. I think it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I will say, I don't know if this is just anecdotal or whatever, but I do think this is something that the queer community does so well, is show up for other marginalized people groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the summer of 2020, when George Floyd was happening, in our city at least, you had the queer community standing up and marching for, you know, equality for Black men and women in the Black community. And in even in times where they were getting pushed to the side by some of the Black advocates and yeah, they were kind of getting pushed aside by the Black activists because they were queer, and they still kept showing up for the oppressed. That's just something that one of the many things that we all have to learn from the queer community.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's why I think we say so much that these movements need to be led by Black trans women, because we need people on the forefront who aren't going to give up at a moment's notice as soon as they're one step higher, but really are committed and get the full picture, you know, have open eyes and aren't in that comfortable spot. So always support your coalitions, but know when it's time to be a quiet support and let the people who are affected, you know, take the lead.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit storyhillbkc.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC. And if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's storyhillbkc.com.
So switching gears a little bit, what is your perspective on church leaders and churches who are, I would call them welcoming, not affirming? In the sense that they're trying to take a non-combative stance towards the LGBTQ community. They don't preach against the community. They don't decry their identities or anything like that. And it may even come up regularly in their sermons, a message of love and equality, but that they still have hard structural limits and lines that can't be crossed. So you're welcome here, but you can't be a deacon, or you can't get married here, or you can't baptize your baby or whatever. So I would call that welcoming, because we want you here, but we're not affirming because we still think there's something wrong with you. Now, it might, you know, there might be a ton of grace language piled on top of we think there's something wrong with you, because there's something wrong with all of us, right? And this is your cross to bear, but it is a cross and you have to bear it faithfully and with repentance. And there's some shame built into that, too. We had a whole episode about that. So what do you think is the appropriate stance of churches like that, or so of leaders in churches like that who are, let's say, sincere and acting in good faith? And then what's the appropriate stance towards churches like that for LGBTQ allies, I guess, or LGBTQ Christians who want to be in those spaces? Or yeah.
You want to start on that one, Alexa?
Sure. I'll kind of answer maybe more direct to the second one. But what that makes me think is, honestly, I think that fairly well describes the like church body that we grew up in, as at least as far as the youth group was concerned. You know, I mean, I don't know about the main service, but it was really sort of a culture of we're, you know, young, hip, cool youth pastor vibes, that we talk about these issues adjacently. We don't ever really say the words, but, you know, we're loving and affirming of everyone. And we don't really say much more. And what that means is when you, especially if you have any amount of power in an organization, decide that you maybe want to be somewhat affirming, but you don't feel like you can say anything, you know, and actually make action on that. That silence by not saying anything, that leaves room for the loudest voices. And the loudest voices are the ones with power, and the ones with power are the people who are not affirming. And so even though the youth group I grew up in, you know, I think if on one-on-one conversations, they would probably tell me they're outright affirming, or at least affirm me in my own experience. I've still, you know, had Sunday school teachers, and I had lots of experiences of really homophobic dynamics. because, you know, you that's just what happens when you're not willing to take a stance. And I understand there's a lot of sort of structural weighing, you know, you're not always positioned to make that, as we talked about with folks who couldn't contribute to the book. Sometimes you're not in a position, but I think that if you recognize that you are an ally who doesn't feel like they can be openly affirming, you need to be making some concrete behind the scenes moves to push your church to become affirming upper leadership, to reach out to kids, both straight and queer, on one-on-one conversations and make sure that they know that, yes, I maybe can't make this proclamation for our youth group, but you are going to be affirmed in all this. And I'm not going to let the sort of insidious creep of homophobia get into our congregation.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm. The problem with churches who are welcoming but not affirming is that they're really not as welcoming as they think they are. Mm-hmm. Because queer people don't feel like they're truly welcome to be who they are in those congregations and places. Now, in my denomination, we have a set of ideas that are on the non-affirming side of things. Some people think it's okay to be queer, but you just can't engage in any kind of sexual behavior between same sex. So it's kind of the celibacy route that you would hear from maybe the Roman Catholic Church. Other people are queer orientation is wrong, and you should go to get healed from that. You should, you know, join one of these Exodus groups or whatever the current names are of the group who try to go through therapy. And that's obviously not an affirming position. There's another stance, though, that's not common in my denomination, but you can find it across Christendom. I find it most often in Lutheran churches, actually. And it's a stance that says, you're welcome here. What you do that's same-sex related, or at least not non-heteronormative, what you do is sinful. But hey, we're all sinners. You know, no sin is worse than another. So I'm not going to object to what you do, but, you know, you're not going to object to my gluttony or whatever. That's better than maybe some of the alternatives, but it still ends up telling queer people that what they're doing is sinful by definition. And so I don't find that the right way to go. What bugs me the most, because I said earlier, I'm in a tradition that says love comes first. What bugs me the most is people who tell me they can't affirm queer people, but they love them. The reason that bugs me is because it seems like what they mean by love is so different than what I mean by love. I think love means affirming what's healthy, and I think queer relationships can be healthy. So it's a misuse of the word love in my way of thinking. I think what they want, what they're really trying to say is, we welcome them, but we're not going to get mad at them. We're not going to shame them or something like that. But that's a nice step forward, but it's not the same as true love. And so that's a real problem in my denomination, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that would have been me 5 years ago, honestly. Yeah. And I felt real angst being told that, like, maybe you're not as loving as you really think you are. And that was something for me to work out, to be honest with you, to really yeah. listen to that voice that was telling me, I don't feel loved by you the way you feel like you love me. And that's not something for that person to work out. That's something for me to work out and for me to figure out, what does love mean to me? And how do I want to be loved and exchanged? And those things are real, I think. So I think we need to give people space to be there, but also want to tell them, you don't have long to be there, because how that person feels loved by you is way more of a clear, honest picture of the way you love them than how you feel like your feelings and disposition is towards them. And I want to just also yeah. just that idea of, you know, welcoming but not affirming, saying, well, maybe you're not as welcoming as you think. I mean, I have friends who lead a church. They have led a church for more than 10 years. And a couple of years ago, we had a little dust up of a person who was queer at our church and went to their church, and they were not accepted, and a big mess happened. And this church leader told me, this is the first gay person that we've had ever in the course of us being a church. And I was like, no, it's not. it's clearly not. You're just not as welcoming as you think, so that people can't be themselves when they're sitting in your chairs, because this person's significant other has been at your church for almost a decade, serving, volunteering in high level ways, and you never knew that he was queer because he didn't feel safe enough to come out to you. So let's, I know there are people who are listening who are either elders, pastors, you know, small group leaders, what influential people in welcoming, not affirming churches. Please just take a moment, take a couple days, take a couple weeks and think about whether you're as welcoming to the queer community as you really think you are, to think about whether you're as loving to the queer community and the queer people that are in your church, whether you know it or not, as you think you are. Because those are really important questions. And if you're in this for the right reasons, right, that question matters.
I also think that that goes back to what we were talking about, the fruit, judging by the fruit, that sure, maybe you can look at these, a really disingenuous reading of judging by the fruit would say, and, you know, I'm sure you've heard this before, you know, queer youth have such a high rate of mental illness and mental distress. Doesn't that mean that something's wrong with them, you know? And I think what's really key there is the personal perspective, you know, that you need to, is this well-being from the perspective of the queer person, you know, take their personal experience into account. And that, I think that's so, so key, Randy, like it doesn't matter how much I'm loving you. If that person doesn't feel loved by you, then you're fundamentally failing. So if we're judging by the fruit, we need to be judging by the fruit of the experience of, quote unquote, the person eating the fruit.
Yeah. And if you have a problem with that, this is coming on strong now, so I apologize ahead of time. But that sounds, if you're saying, well, no, I love you and I don't care how you feel, it's what I feel that matters, that sounds kind of abusive, doesn't it?
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, to welcoming, non-affirming, I mean, I've been in networks. I mean, so you're dealing with the Church of Nazarene, Tom. I mean, I was in the 24/7 prayer network, and that 24/7 global prayer network has a church network that's part of it. And these are full of people who seemingly love queer people. And I mean, love all people, I believe, to a certain extent, and are welcoming, non-affirming. And when we went affirming and people found out about it, we got the boot really fast. And we were actually told you can be friends of the movement, but not family. And I was like, whoa, that's what so many queer people hear, both in their own families of origin and in the church. And can we be careful with that? But to say that, just to drive in the point of welcoming but not affirming doesn't always mean welcoming.
Yeah. I'm going to rock some theology on you here.
All right? Come on.
Last time we were together, I talked about open relational theology. And I said that relational theology says that God is not just giving, but also receiving. God not only affects us, but God is affected. Most Christian theologians in history have not believed God is relational. They've not believed God is receiving. They've thought love was always outgoing and benevolent. Now imagine what it is to be a Christian who's trying to live in the image of God and think that love is always about fixing everybody else. It's not about receiving from them. It's not about listening from them. If you have a view of divine love that says God receives, God listens, and we should imitate that, this can help us in the queer, in the conversations with queer people and trying to figure out how we should act in a loving way, because it means that we're not just out to give and to be generous, but also we need to receive and listen and amass information to know how to then give in response. So, sorry, I got to throw some theology in there, Randy.
I love it.
To the welcoming but not affirming folks who, or position that is the, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin. Basically, you can be gay, but don't act on it. You know, we hate the behavior, the lifestyle. Oh, the words.
I hate that one.
I hate the lifestyle. I mean, if you want to, and I hope that they do, proclaim loudly that God is a God of love and that, you know, love is the number one priority, reconciling someone, a queer person, to a life in which, you know, they can never seek a partner if they want one, and to the, you know, that celibacy, both emotional, spiritual, and also sexual, especially if your church bans masturbation, like, man, you are condemning them to a really sad life. And that is just, I don't know how you sit with that, by saying, I'm loving you by removing this entire aspect of love from the, from your potential life, an aspect that God gave you, you know. It just, I don't think that that holds water.
We need to listen to that.
That's my daughter talking there. That's my daughter.
Yeah, dude. Let's go, Tom.
I remember there was an LGBT like activism group on my undergraduate campus, and they would hold events and give them really like shockingly sounding titles, like Live Gay Acts in the Quad. And then you would go and they would be like cooking breakfast.
Incredible.
displaying the gay lifestyle.
Tell me what you think about this, Tom, and your experience. But for me, pastorally, being non-affirming was actually detrimental to giving my whole congregation an understanding and an outworking of our sexuality that promotes human flourishing or well-being, like you're saying, and sexual health and even purity. I hate using that word, but it still means something. Being affirming as a pastor allows me pastorally to offer our queer members a sexual ethic that is attainable, healthy, consistent with our straight members, and I think consistent with the scriptures. Can you speak to that dynamic a little bit of like, actually moving to an affirming stance helps us pastor people better?
Yeah, let me give you a very specific instance. I told you that the Church of Nazarene comes from the Methodist or Wesleyan tradition, and we are the largest organized holiness group in the world. So we represent the holiness tradition, and part of holiness biblically has been purity. Well, if we really care about purity in the sense of staying faithful to one's partner for a lifetime, we ought to be at the very front in the same-sex marriage agenda. We ought to be pushing for laws that support and protect same-sex relationships, because what we're doing is we're saying we really care about lifelong commitments, and we know same-sex people can be as horny as anybody else. Why not have them be committed in a lifelong situation, be it sanctioned by civil law, by the church? That's a way in which we can actually affirm the purity of the scriptures by affirming same-sex marriage. In terms of the sexuality thing and sort of once you become affirming, welcoming and affirming, how that helps your sexual, how it helps you promote a healthy sexuality overall, I think one of the best... Here I'm talking theoretically because I haven't been a pastor for quite some time, at least not a lead pastor. Mm-hmm. But I think in congregations that are affirming, there is a greater sense of sexual diversity such that people can have greater freedom not to have to live up to certain stereotypes, including the stereotype among men that men are macho, masculine, you know, let's watch football, whatever. There's lots of men who are not like that.
Not that there's anything wrong with football.
Nothing wrong with football. But you get, or, you know, let's take the female side, you know, dainty, feminine, you know, wear pink, whatever. Once you start affirming a diversity of sexual expressions, then people feel far more comfortable having a diversity of, I'll call it gender expressions, or my terminology is probably not right. And Lexi can correct me.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I think that makes even straight people feel better about expressing themselves in authentic ways.
Alexa, what's your take on that? Even though you're, you know, removed yourself from the church and all that stuff, but you've been in church circles. What do queer people hear? They're trying their best. They're at church. Like, a queer person at church means that's a remarkable Christian, a person who really loves Jesus and really loves the church and is willing to tolerate a lot of BS because of it, right? And then you're told, oh, no big deal here. Just don't ever be sexual at all. as a human being. What do, like, what, help me, help us out here. Like, what do you, what's the response to that as a queer person?
I mean, leave. And I think this also kind of gets at sort of, as we hinted at earlier, Tom and my sort of, we don't quite see eye to eye on, you know, if we were forced at gunpoint to draw the line on affirming, that, you know, but this is sort of the thing about, I am not a part of the church. And so if the church wants to say that we prioritize monogamous, long-term committed relationships, great. You know, that's fine. You know, I'm all here. Go out and have as much casual, gay, horny sex as you want. Go to town, man. But that's not, you know, I'm not a part of the church, so I don't get to make those rules. But all this being said, wouldn't it be better if we were all having casual, gay, horny sex? Or whatever that looks like. I agree. I think, Tom, that's a really interesting point that I have never thought of, that having an affirming church really helps break down, you know, patriarchy hurts us all, man. It really helps break down those barriers and explore a more authentic being for everyone, you know, not just queer people. And even further, I think a sort of tangentially to becoming queer affirming is sort of the quote unquote, like the lowercase q queer affirming, even though you don't capitalize queer, but you know, which is the sort of queer meaning against the grain, resisting the status quo, counteracting sort of the powers that be. Having a queer theology and a queer church can be really, really fruitful for rethinking sort of the structures of how, of what church and what religion has always been taught to you. If you instead take a lesson from your queer community and queer everything around you, you know, queer your sermons and your communion and your fellowship and your songs, that honestly is so incredibly fruitful. Like, you can really explore so much more by taking queerness as sort of an ethic rather than just, you know, a behavior or a type of person.
I like that.
Yep. Last thing, because Tom, you address this to your tradition, who I'm assuming you care somewhat about, at least. Yeah, otherwise you would not be in this arduous process of going to trial, which I don't even know what that means. That's high church and I can't do it. But the conversation can be so gut-wrenchingly slow and lack any urgency in church leadership circles. You know, I mean, I just know there's people listening to this who are intrigued, but who it's not even close to being, let's talk about this at our next elder meeting, but it is urgent for queer people and their lives are at stake, especially queer people and queer youth in the church. And we seem to be losing large swaths of young people because of this conversation,
yep,
queer and straight. So, Tom, what would you say to the pastor or elder or leader in a local congregation who aren't having these conversations or who are having these conversations, but at a snail's pace?
Well, I would begin by saying, at least three different denominations have approached us since this book came out 6 weeks ago about doing a book like this for their denomination. So I would say to people, maybe you don't need to edit a book, but there might be some things you could do to jumpstart that conversation by getting people involved and putting things out in the social media world and generally speaking. The Church of the Nazarene, up until the publication of this book, very, very, I'm tempted to say none, but very, very little public discussion of these issues. If a person just raised the question, they were looked at in negative ways. But this book has stirred a hornet's nest up in our denomination. People are pissed. And, you know, people are losing their jobs because of this. There's resolutions to change things. You know, I won't be surprised if I get kicked out. And so there's, I'm not saying it's easy, but people are talking about this now. And you could do some things to get conversations going. It's risky, but you can do some things. Maybe you don't want to take as big a risk as we did, but think about strategies for furthering the conversation.
Yeah. And I mean, in my perspective, include queer voices in those conversations. They're not real conversations if they don't include queer people. And I want to say this book is, even though it's addressed to the Church of the Nazarene, use this book if what we're saying right now resonates with you, church leaders or, you know, influential church people. Use this book as a resource. Buy this book because these voices, there are a wide variety of voices from different angles, from biblical scholarship and from the queer community and from people in the church who care about the church. So use this as it's not unique to the Church of the Nazarene is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
But please have these conversations.
I also think it's really valuable to not just, I mean, if you want to buy 100 copies of the book and give it to all your pastors, go right ahead. I won't stop you. But I think it's really important to, if you are inspired by what we're trying to do here with the Church of the Nazarene, to replicate it in some way within your own context. You know, I think part of what's so powerful about this book is the names are names that people recognize. You know, their stories are, I'm a third, fourth generation Nazarene. It's about our specific community and culture. And this does translate to other denominations, but you can be even more powerful if you get the stories of your community and your congregation and aggregate those. I think that you can really, really speak to the heart of your specific context.
And I want to appeal just to, if the question is, well, I've talked to pastors like this who literally will, after I publicly came out, say, hey, can we grab lunch? And then they say, I'm affirming. I just want to keep my job. You know?
So many things. I've got so many notes from those kinds of pastors since this came out. Yep.
He said, oh, hell. I just want to remind us. I just want to humbly remind us, and us, I mean, church leaders. I want to remind us of why we got into this in the first place. And I hope you didn't get into it to be super influential and, you know, get book deals and have huge income because of it. I hope you got into this vocation because you really believed in the person of Christ and the manifestation of his body on earth called the church that I think is going to bring healing and life to the world. That's why we're in this, not for bottom lines, not for butts in the seats, not for income, not for any of that stuff. We can get a second job, but the church is something that's way more important than our bottom line or our success or failure. And it might be worth, you know, people, there's this kind of, you know, idea out there that going affirming is so easy. It's caving to culture is what they say. You have no idea how not easy going affirming as a Protestant church is. But it's fully worth it because again, if we're actually in the business of human flourishing and the kingdom of God advancing, it's just a slam dunk.
I tell you, the altars are open. The spirit is moving. Come forward, Pastor Randy. Has invited us all.
Nice. Alexa and Tom, so good to chat with you. Really appreciate you, both of your perspectives. They're so important, so needed. And hopefully look forward to talking to both of you again.
Thanks, Randy. Thanks a lot, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, that's it for this episode of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar. We hope you're enjoying the show as much as we are. Help us continue to create compelling content and reach a wider audience by supporting us at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher, where you can get bonus content, extra perks, and a general feeling of being a good person.
Also, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and Spotify. These help new people discover the show, and we may even read your review in a future episode, if it's good enough.
If anything you said really pissed you off, or if you just have a question you'd like us to answer, or if you'd just like to send us booze, send us an email at pastorandphilosopher@gmail.com.
Catch all of our hot takes on Twitter at PPWB Podcast, at Randy Nye, and at Robert K. Whitaker, and find transcripts and links to all of our episodes at pastorandphilosopher.buzzsprout.com. See you next time.
Cheers.